This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
January 2019, the hard-traveling fanboys are celebrating Aquaman the movie's $1 billion box office performance with a special extension of Aquamonth.
Right, ain't over yet.
Good Lord, I can't do it.
You probably should have attempted that intro during actual Aquamonth instead of now.
Well, you know what? That might have been a good idea, Nick. But for 1 week only, Aquamonth is extending into January.
Yeah, we're just going to extend Aquamonth anytime we decide to do something related to Aquaman.
That's exactly right. We're not going to waste a good name like Aquamonth. Nope. Now, you are listening, of course. I am Greg Phillips. He is Nick Duke. We are the hard-traveling fanboys. We come to you once again from the luxurious, world-renowned studios, L-shaped studios, that is, in Hoholoon Plaza in the quaint northwestern town of Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Now, we are bringing to you this week an episode of Off the Page. This is our continuing series where we like to examine a piece of comic book media that is not an actual comic book. Usually this takes the form of TV and movies. Sometimes it can be games, occasionally radio plays, script reviews, which
Have we ever actually done a radio play for this?
No, nor have we done that script review that we kept saying we were going to do for a long time. We haven't done that yet, but we will.
We will.
That is our pledge to our audience that we don't mind breaking if it never happens.
Right.
We will one day do the script review and the radio review that we've promised doing. But nonetheless,
did we ever pick a radio play we were going to do, or we said we had the vague concept of doing a radio play at some point?
I don't know. We should do Nightfall so we can talk about Benedict Asp.
Or do Final Crisis so we can talk about the actual audio representation of Superman singing to fix the hole in forever or whatever.
The hole in forever. Speaking of holes in forever, Nick, this is a little bit of a rabbit that I'm going to chase for a moment here. Our plan for next week's episode, tentatively speaking, is to review the Grant Morrison Batman epic known as Batman R.I.P.
Yes.
So as part of this, I began attempting to read this story
The
weekend, and, well, sir, it ain't good.
No, it's not.
And not only is it not good, it's borderline incomprehensible.
Yep.
However, on page 4 or 5, I only got about 7 pages in so far. On page 4 or 5 of this nonsensical rambling mess, there is the introduction of Monsieur Le Bossu, which reminded me of a great scene from the Hulk Hogan film, No Holds Barred. And I think you know what I'm referring to, Nick, when I refer to Monsieur Le Who?
Monsieur Le Who? Yes, yes, that's good. I can't laugh too much this week for fear of it turning into a coughing fit, so I'm going to try and restrict
I believe that you've caught the dreaded McGregor syndrome.
McGregor syndrome. Take 2 of these and call me in the morning. Yeah, that whole deal.
And it's free from the App Store.
I'm free from the App Store. Damn it, all the hell. You're killing me, Phillips.
You're doing David's laugh now. This is good. Anyway, this is going to be a fun episode, folks. So, all that being said, we are doing Off the Page, and the reason that we're extending Aquamonth is that, well, it's twofold. Number one, still relevant because it is dominating the box office. I think it's just recently been overtaken for the number one movie in America. Now it's the number two movie in America. That is James Wan's Aquaman. Made $1 billion at the box office worldwide, the first DC Extended Universe film to do so. And so we were thinking, hey, how else can we talk about Aquaman? But the real reason that we're doing this is because DC Universe, the app that we so mocked a week ago, did something really cool this month, and they uploaded the previously unaired pilot for an Aquaman TV series that was planned to be launched in the mid-2000s on what is now the CW network and what was then the WB network. Oh, the WB! And, that didn't sound good, Nick. I don't know if you heard that, but...
No, I didn't. What
happened?
Sounded
like a woman screaming in the background.
No, but,
we're just going to ignore that.
It's none of your business,
Move
Greg.
Along. So the,
Real men, Greg, would just let that abuse continue.
The WB television network, had a pilot for an Aquaman TV series that was going to run sort of parallel with Smallville. This was in the middle of Smallville's 10-year run. And, unfortunately, the show never got off the ground, but the pilot has now been, seen a lot because they put it on, some DVD releases of Smallville, and now it is, available everywhere on the WB, or not the WB app, the DC app. It was created by Al Gow and Miles Millar, and I don't know if I pronounced either of their names right, the creators of Smallville, and it was recorded in it was supposed to debut in 2006, fall of 2006, never quite happened, but we decided, with this out there, we've got to review this. Nick and I, for some reason, are really into the idea of reviewing all of these, like, sort of unaired pilot episodes or failed comic book series from over the years. There's so many of them out there. So many have yet to see the light of day as well. We're still looking, Nick, for a good version of that infamous 1997 JLA pilot to review. But we have gotten the NBC Wonder Woman pilot. David E. Kelly, I believe, was the writer of that. And we reviewed that on this show, which starred one, Adrian Palicki, which will tie into our episode tonight. But in this case, we're going to turn back the clock to 2006, and we are going to review what was supposed to be the launch of a brand new series, Aquaman. So what you can do right now is if you have the DC Universe app, or if you have that DVD of whatever season it is of Smallville that they included this on, you can pull that up right now. We'll give you a chance to pause the podcast, get that going. We are going to pull it up, and in fact, now that I say that, I need to pull it up on my screen and get it paused. And for some reason, my app closed out on my TV here. So I'm going to buy time for a moment, Nick. And while we do that, had you ever seen this episode before?
No, I was not. I was not a Smallville fan, so I never intended to seek this out, really. It just kind of is one of the things I heard about, and I assumed I wouldn't like, so I didn't watch it at the time.
Yeah, I heard about this when it was happening because I was a big Smallville fan, and I remember hearing that this was, you know, in the works. But I, you know, I'd never seen it until preparation for this episode began. So, with that being said, folks, we are going to hit play in 3, 2, 1, play. Right now, we start with a shot of the ocean and a narrator talking over some shots of undersea creatures kind of swimming around. These are actual marine creatures. And it appears that this is the mother of our titular character, our breastular character, Aquaman. So this would be Atlanta, actually.
So there's the first question I have, because I have lots of questions about this that you might be able to answer, seeing as how you probably followed this closer than I did at the time. I always thought the rumored title of this was actually Mercy Reef, to kind of, you know, tie into Smallville a little bit with naming it after a place rather than the character himself.
Yeah, that was a working title for this. It was, you know, originally going to be called it was sort of went under a lot of different working titles, and Mercy Reef was one of them that it was kind of known by in development. But eventually they settled on they settled on Aquaman, and it was kind of Tempest Keys was another one, basically. It went between Tempest Keys and Mercy Reef, which were working titles to go along with the motif of Smallville, which, of course, was named after the city. But eventually when it got dropped on iTunes after it was known that it was not going to be picked up as a series, that's when it got known as Aquaman. So at the time that it was being worked on, it was called in many circles Mercy Reef. But, you know, sort of after the time had passed, they were like, what the hell, it's just called Aquaman. I don't believe it probably would have been called Aquaman if it had actually gone to series. They probably would have called it either Mercy Reef or Tempest Keys or something like that. Mm-hmm. So that's the answer to that. But this version of Atlanta at first appears to just be a normal pilot, and her husband is Tom Curry. In this case, he's a military man, and he's played by Lou Diamond Phillips, mm-hmm. who is a pretty famous actor, I would say, and been a lot of stuff over the years. And here we see young Arthur Curry as a small boy with an appropriately mid-90s bowl cut in this image. I thought that was kind of a cool touch by the producers of this show.
The only time a bowl cut has ever been referred to as a cool touch, for the record.
True, because it's appropriate for the time. Because most kids in the mid-90s had this stupid haircut.
Yeah,
the
stupid
bowl cut.
Yep.
Yeah, so Lou Diamond Phillips is upset now because his wife's plane is crashing. He doesn't know what's going on. Mm-hmm. She crashes in the ocean, and that's when we really get a glimpse of this mysterious necklace around her neck that has begun to glow. As this entire plot of this pilot episode revolves around the Bermuda Triangle. What is going on with the Bermuda Triangle? And this plane crashes there. She leaves the necklace with Arthur, and somehow he's able to survive underwater. He doesn't know what's going on. He's scared. And she gets sort of seized by this creature, and that kicks us off on our show. That's kind of the origin of Arthur Curry and how he becomes who he is. Now, Nick, this is obviously a very different take on the Aquaman origin, but it's a lot like what we saw at the movie. It is paying homage sort of to different takes on the character and keeping Tom Curry, keeping Atlanta, keeping Orin, even from the Peter David run, as his mother calls him Orin right before she's taken. What are your thoughts on this opening? I actually thought it was pretty effective at setting the origin up for this character and this version of, as we'll later call him, AC becomes.
Yeah, it's fine. I enjoyed it pretty well. As with anything of this era, you're going to kind of have to quibble with some of the special effects at times, you know, with the light coming out of the ocean, or some of the shots of the plane, which looked CGI'd as well. But, you know, visual quibbles aside, it's fairly engaging and catches your attention right away.
Yeah, and he's even saved by a whale here, which is another really good touch. And for its time, I think this looks really good, actually, most of it. There are some of the boat scenes later on look really, mm-hmm. really fake, mm-hmm. but overall, I was actually impressed with the visuals of this for a pilot in 2006 for a non-major network channel. So I don't know. I think they got up to a good start here and sort of setting a template for something that was going to end up surprising me, because I'm like you, Nick. I expected to dislike this. I expected it to be cheesy and not good.
Well, yeah, because
times it is cheesy, but
because it didn't get picked up. We all assume that if it didn't get picked up, it must have been bad, you know?
It must not have been any good. It must have been below the level of shows like the Beverly Hills 90210 reboot, or mm-hmm. The Melrose Place reboot, or the Dynasty reboot.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, you know, even right here, we get our first look at a grown-up AC played by who would become a pretty famous name, Justin Hartley. This was sort of his first big exposure in a lot of ways, and he was actually so beloved by the producers of this episode that they wanted him to come on to Smallville. Well, unfortunately, they had already cast an Aquaman on Smallville, so they got Justin Hartley to come on and play Oliver Queen, a.k.a. the Green Arrow. That's where fans really grew to know and love Justin Hartley. Now he is one of the stars of NBC's This Is Us, which is one of the most successful dramas on TV right now. So pretty good career arc for Justin Hartley starts right here. And here he is playing, I think, a version of Arthur Curry that, although he's never called Arthur Curry in this, he's just called AC, but he is a version that I think is pretty recognizable. He's kind of not really found a direction in life. He goes around, he tries to rescue marine life when he feels they're being abused. He's kind of bumming around the marina. You're trying to run this business with his friend. But he, you know, he's sort of a slacker. He's not putting his all into his life. He's not putting his all into academics. He's just kind of, so to speak, floating by. Did you find this to be a pretty understandable version of Arthur compared to what we've seen in the comics and what we've seen in other media?
Yeah, I mean, we haven't really spent a whole lot of time in modern-day comics anyway with art with Aquaman before he becomes Aquaman. You know, the runs that you and I are most familiar with, predominantly the Geoff Johns run, the Dan Annette stuff, it's not really, you know, origins don't really feature into it a whole lot. So for me, this pre-Aquaman version of Arthur Curry is kind of a blank slate. Like, I don't really have an attachment to any particular version. So this works for me as well as anything.
I also liked Lou Diamond Phillips in the Tom Curry role, although it's interesting that they introduce a lighthouse keeper in
this, but it's not him
later on. But it's not Tom Curry; it's someone else. And Tom Curry is kind of a military man. What is his job exactly? He's like kind of
he's
like
in the Coast Guard,
air traffic controller.
No, he's in the Coast Guard. That's
Yeah,
because that's how he meets Atlanta. They say eventually,
Which is kind of an interesting twist. Again, it's something another little change that I kind of like. Kind of fits for the vibe of this show, and you know he's established.
And this is supposed to be Florida somewhere? Is that the implication?
Yeah, it's in the Keys, yeah. Okay. Tempest Key is supposed to be somewhere in the Florida Keys, and Mercy Reef is something that's a few, like, 15 miles off of that, I think, and pretty close to the Bermuda Triangle, I guess. I don't know geography that well, people that are listening, so if I'm way off on my geography here,
you don't know biology either.
No, don't know much about history either. Don't know much trigonometry.
Mm-hmm.
You going to finish the line for me, Nick?
Nope.
Oh, damn it. And here we meet Arthur's attractive friend, Eve.
Yes. Arthur has no shortage of attractive friends in this episode.
Yes. And now they are just platonic friends, though, right, Nick?
I don't know. I get the implication that they weren't. That there have been moments here between these two.
There may have been. I get the feeling that maybe she's more into him than he is into her, though.
Because he's an idiot.
Well, yeah. Absolutely. But that's the impression that I get here. Because she lets him get away with a lot. I mean, he just got arrested for breaking in and trying to save succeeding in saving two dolphins and putting their business in danger. And he's wanting her to loan him money so that he can fight his legal charges. You know, that's not a very good business plan, Nick.
No, it's not.
And they don't appear to have that many customers, by the way.
No.
Well, I take that back. They do have that party that goes on later on, but, you know, were any of those people actually paying? I didn't see any money change hands.
Given the attire of the employees, particularly the female employees, I don't see how this place doesn't have business. It's not bad.
Certainly beats the front porch in Troy, Alabama, I can tell you that.
Yes, most things do.
And this is another thing. This is our first kind of glimpse at some of his powers. We've already seen him swimming at, like, incredibly fast speeds underwater, but here he kind of implies that he has a connection with the marine life, and she asks, so you're talk to fish now? And he kind of has that Geoff Johns line of, well, they're mammals, it's not really talking with them, it's just a form of empathy. So they don't go as far as being able to push or control the animals yet, but he feels some sort of connection with them. So again, so far, this is pretty true to Arthur Curry, as far as I know him. Now, let's talk a little bit about the background of the show while we have a chance, while we're doing just setup here. So, you mentioned some confusion about how this whole thing came about.
Yes, I do have a little bit of confusion because I had always assumed it was going to be in-universe with Smallville, but, like, as someone who didn't watch Smallville, I've only ever tried to watch the first season and honestly found it found it difficult to get through, so I gave up. I was under the assumption that this guy had already played Green Arrow, and yet this was going to be in-universe somehow, but you cleared a lot of that up for me earlier.
Yes, so how this works is Smallville's highest-rated episode of the previous season, the fifth season of Smallville, they had an episode named Aqua that introduced their version of Arthur Curry, AC,
who is played by Alan Ritchson, who is currently playing Hawk on DC's Titans. That episode was the highest rated episode of the season for Smallville. This sort of was not intended to be a backdoor pilot for an Aquaman show or anything, but it was so successful that WB came to Miles Millar and Alfred Gow and asked them if they would do something with the character. Luckily, they had already had an idea for doing something with the Aquaman legend, as they put it. They also had an idea for a Lois Lane series, but felt more confident in Aquaman. So anyway, they come up with this whole concept of what they want to do with Aquaman, how they want to tell the story. They also wanted it to be completely separate from Smallville, at least for now. From what I've read in interviews that they did at the time, they said that they would be open to the idea of a crossover at some point, but at this point they wanted to make it separate, make it its own thing, and make it a little bit different tonally and structurally from Smallville. And so that's kind of what they went about doing here. And so what the first thing they did was they knew they didn't want Alan Ritchson to play this version of Aquaman. So they went out and they found Justin Hartley. So from there, they wanted to build it up, and they wanted it to have sort of almost an X-Files kind of vibe to it a little bit on the side, which we'll talk about a little bit later on this episode, but also have maybe a little bit more of a mature vibe than Smallville, which was focusing a lot on the teen angst at the time. So that's kind of what we're getting here, and this is more of a focus on the mystery or the action-adventure aspect than what you might expect from the WB or now the CW from their original series. And that led to what we have. They took a chance on it. They went through the long process of casting, the long process of figuring out a name, which never really got settled completely. And they went about the idea of a show about Arthur sort of learning to become Aquaman, which is sort of the trend, right, in superhero media at that time. People loved origin stories, and they loved seeing how the heroes become the heroes.
Right.
And at that time, Hollywood was particularly averse to actually seeing the heroes in superhero costumes.
Right.
It seemed.
You know, compare it, like we were talking about earlier before we came on air. This kind of was created in an era where there was, like you said, this bizarre aversion to heroes in costumes. Think of X-Men with the black leather instead of the comic book accurate costumes. Think of Smallville, where notoriously he doesn't actually appear in the Superman suit until, what, the last episode of the series or something like that?
Yeah.
Is that accurate?
That's correct.
And see, we knew coming into this there was no way you were actually going to see him in any kind of comic book accurate Aquaman suit. Because, like I said, it was just the style at the time. Compare that to something like the era we live in today, where in their respective first episodes, Arrow and Flash and Black Lightning and various other properties are all running around in comic book accurate costumes because the assumption is that society as a whole is just more accustomed to these sort of things and won't laugh it out of the room the way it was thought they would back then.
Right, exactly. The emphasis back then was on make it as close to reality as possible, even if it's fantastical. And at times that had mixed results because some of these concepts you just can't get too realistic with. And I would include living in an underwater kingdom as part of that. Right. So this was actually a pretty cool scene, by the way. This is one of the ones that stood out to me in a positive way visually of Aquaman or AC racing the fighter jet. They send this, what's her name? Lieutenant Rachel Torres. They send her to investigate this crash after they found somebody stranded in the ocean that has the same necklace that Arthur has. And this lieutenant, her plane crashes in the Bermuda Triangle in the same way that Arthur's mom's plane did when he was a kid. But in the meantime, he's racing this fighter jet underwater and ends up saving her life. And I really thought that scene for the era looked really good, the way they sort of visualized his ability to swim at high speeds.
Yeah, and being that the WB was kind of the CW of its time, you can't have enough attractive female potential love interests hanging around at any given point. So they use this opportunity to work another one in here, and I'll allow it.
Yeah. You'll allow it?
I'll allow it.
Yeah. So this is the aforementioned Lieutenant Torres, and she's had her life saved by Arthur under some weird circumstances. She doesn't remember much, but she does remember going her plane going down in the weird flash of light, and remembers Arthur bringing her to safety. So that's sort of setting up this other side plot that we're about to see introduced here. And that involves sort of what turns into a little bit of an X-Files kind of vibe, introducing, for Smallville fans out there, so this isn't for you, Nick, but for the Smallville folks out there, sort of what I would assume to be this show's version of the Wall of Weird on Smallville, where that was set up the villain of the month sort of formula, or villain of the week sort of formula, as there's this shady government operative that shows up, and he is part of this secret organization working for the government to investigate people who seem to be reappearing that were lost in time, folks that disappeared in the 1920s or the 1930s, and suddenly they're showing up with these necklaces and coming from the water. And so the government is investigating these people to try to figure out what their story is, what they have in common, what they're all about. And as we find out in this episode, these are actually the Atlanteans. These appear to be former surface dwellers who have somehow, under mysterious circumstances, ended up underwater for decades and now serve Atlantis in some way.
Yeah, I was going to say, but are they actually Atlanteans? Like,
we don't know.
Yeah, that's part of the thing is, like, because later on, there's that other character, Ving Rhames character, will pop up and, like, the implication you get is that there are actual Atlanteans, of which Atlanta and he and Arthur would be part of, and then there are these people who are former surface dwellers who became affiliated with Atlantis in some way. And so,
in some way,
I would assume that the connection between those two things would have been one of the things that would have been explored over the course of the first season.
Yeah, it's a little frustrating because some of these mysteries here are actually intriguing, and I was interested to see where they're going. That's one of them. Who are the Atlanteans? What is this version of Atlantis? Because we don't really get a clear answer on that. Oh, Lord Almighty.
Good Lord.
We're about to be introduced to Adrian Palicki is actually in this episode, and she is playing...
She sure as shit is, Greg.
She is playing the character of Nadia, a.k.a. Siren.
Mm.
And she's introduced as one of several sirens, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But here, I want to talk more about this subplot. So we get this investigation going on. Lieutenant Torres ends up getting recruited into this investigation of the Atlanteans. So it's setting up that plot going forward. I'm assuming that this would have led to a conflict between Torres and Arthur as he eventually finds out that she's been tasked with investigating him. And
then eventually finds out that she's also one of the people who was formerly there in Atlantis, because that's revealed at the end of the episode.
Yep, that's revealed at the end of the episode. So it's really interesting how they're setting all this stuff up. I was actually shockingly intrigued by this. So
the worst part of the subplot is this guy playing the lead government agent. One,
yes,
he's given the worst dialogue of any character in the entire episode, and two, he is delivering it in the most, like, over-the-top and cheesy fashion imaginable.
He's also way too young to play this character.
Yes, he's like, everything about that character is awful, but the subplot itself is fairly interesting.
It's good, yeah. I think they should have cast someone that looks, you know, more of a middle-aged kind of guy.
They
should
have just gotten that guy. Like, I'm not a huge X-Files fan, but who was the guy that replaced David Duchovny for a little while.
Oh, T-1000.
Yeah, Robert. They should have just gotten Robert Patrick, because that's kind of the vibe I get from this guy anyway.
Yeah, and if you think that Robert Patrick would be too big a name to go on this unaired pilot, you'd be wrong, because while Adrian Palicki, Lord Almighty,
Jesus
was not a household name at this point, Ving Rhames is in this episode.
Uh-huh.
Well, let's talk about Ving Rhames later, though. Right now, Siren is attempting to seduce AC, and it is working.
As it would.
Speaking of wood, So apparently, it's established later on from Ving Rhames' character that sirens, when they stare at a male or a man, they can make them do whatever they want, and that is what's going on right here as she's putting Arthur under her spell. Now, Adrian Palicki has an interesting history with comic book properties, Nick. We talked about the
Jesus.
We talked about this a little bit on our Wonder Woman pilot episode that we did because she played. So she's in this as Siren. She pops up 5 years later as Wonder Woman on the NBC Wonder Woman pilot. Later on, she ends up playing Mockingbird on Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
And was rumored to get her own spinoff show that would have focused on her and her boyfriend on that show, Hunter's couple, their relationship. It would have been called Marvel's Most Wanted. And
go you one further. They filmed a pilot episode for that.
And that show
has never been aired.
It was never aired and was not picked up. And so they were going to bring her back on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but then she signed a deal to do the Orville over on Fox, and that precluded her from being able to come back to Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. So
she has the unique distinction, through no fault of her own, by the way. She's awesome.
Yes.
She has the distinction of having been in three pilots for comic book series that never got picked up.
Yes.
Weird bit of trivia.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, she was at least good in all of the in both of these two unaired pilots that we have reviewed on this part, but that Wonder Woman show around her was a complete and total disaster.
Yes.
You know, this, as we'll talk about later, I'm not entirely sure the reasoning for it not getting picked up.
I'm not either.
Now, let me ask you now, since we can stop being distracted by her for the moment. What do they call it? What does Ving Rhames give his name as in this? McConnell or something like that?
McCaffrey.
McCaffrey. Am I the only one? I mean, I'm assuming.
He's Vulko.
Yeah, I was assuming that eventually they would reveal his Atlantean name as Vulko.
It's Vulko, yeah. Right. 100%. He's absolutely Vulko. And let me just say, I remember when this happened at the time, by the way, in the school newspaper office, the Trop. I remember telling somebody, I don't remember who it was, that, like, how in the hell did they get Ving Rhames, who was a big star at that time, to be in a TV pilot for the WB? That had to be most of their budget, right?
Yeah, you would think so, but then, like we've said, the show doesn't look terrible around it.
No. So Ving Rhames is here playing this, this what we assume to be Vulko, and he's awesome. He's Ving Rhames. He's intimidating. He's mysterious. He has pretty cool lines, just referring to the mysteries of the deep. He ain't taking no shit off of Arthur, I gotta be honest, man. Ving Rhames as Vulko works for me.
What I love about him is that he drinks water out of a flask.
Yes, he's
he came to the bar earlier and got a shot of rum. So you would think, hey, he's drinking a flask. It's probably got rum in it. Nope. Later on, they reveal it's just water. He just drinks water out of a flask.
Yeah, well, one of the other good lines in this is as he's telling AC about his history in Atlantis, AC says, yeah, you've been drinking too much. It's pickled your brain, which is a pretty good line.
Mm-hmm.
Pickled your brain. Anyway, Nick, have you ever thought that your brain was being pickled?
No, lots of times. Lots of times.
Of course, Ving Rhames isn't very happy about his Atlantean story being mocked by AC. That's not... You know, he's not happy about that. So it's setting up also the story of AC's father. And the interesting thing here is Vulko explains that his dad was a man of peace. And we know that in other versions of this origin, assuming that his father be revealed to be Atlan, he was not necessarily a man of peace. So maybe that's going to be revealed later on. Maybe Vulko would eventually turn on Arthur. Who knows? But... pretty good stuff here with Ving Rhames playing his role. One of the things that this pilot episode did well that other pilot episodes don't do well all the time is set up the supporting cast and set up the main players moving forward. I thought it did a pretty good job of that. There's a couple of clunky things in there. I thought that as much as I was talking about how interesting that subplot was, I thought that at times I felt it kind of took away a little bit from – you know, getting to know Arthur and getting to know his story. But nonetheless, they do a good job of setting up the table for who these players are. And especially as we get closer to the end of the episode, setting up the intrigue of what this version of Atlantis is going to look like and what Arthur's training is going to look like. Because even Arthur is shocked in the end when he's ready to, quote, begin using tridents and stuff, and instead he's told to read Shakespeare, and that, told that that's part of his training. So I was curious to see where they were going to go with that as well.
One other thing I find interesting here is that we see him throughout the episode in a like either a light green T-shirt or a light orange T-shirt, and either green swim trunks or orange swim trunks. So they kind of had him like nods to the classic Aquaman costume without going the full Monty, so to speak.
Very true. Although there was that one scene with he and Siren underwater where they were going the full.
Oh God. So this is like the one person in his life that he's told about his powers and stuff, I get the impression.
Yeah. Although I have to say, this is another thing that didn't quite sit right with me. She accepts his story far too easily, in my opinion.
Well, I would assume that she's probably like she's the like we said, the one person that he's told, you know, shown his powers to, so she knows he can breathe underwater and swim at like, you know, rapid speed. So she's probably already had to overcome suspend some disbelief as it relates to him.
True.
Throughout their history together.
That's true. That's fair. And she is showing him a level of support to which he seems to be oblivious on some level. But nonetheless, they're getting ready. They're bracing for a storm to come in. And unfortunately, the storm does not bode well for young Eve.
No, it does not.
So, again, one of the things that we talked about with the Wonder Woman pilot that bothered us so much was that they took a character in Wonder Woman that is so well defined, and they pretty well stripped away every aspect that defines her character in favor of putting her in a generic, you know, TV series, basically. And I think that was my fear going into this. I feared that this was going to be the same thing. It was going to be, quote, a CW show or WB show in this case, and would not do service to the Aquaman character. But I thought they did a pretty good job through the constraints of that time period of not falling into the same trap that the David Kelly show did five years later, inexplicably.
You get the impression here that if there's an element of the character that isn't portrayed in this episode, it's because it's something they're building to.
They're building to, yeah.
Whereas the Wonder Woman pilot felt so completely divorced from any interpretation of the character we had known before that it didn't really feel like they could ever build to anything because it just felt like it's wholly own original creation with only really the costume and the name in common.
Yeah, and as good as the lead performance was, as charming as she was, it's just too hard to get a you can't turn Wonder Woman into Ally McBeal, and that's what it was seemingly doing. Now we do have this sort of like dual subplot of information that the audience has that the main character doesn't have. So AC is completely unaware of this government investigation, completely unaware of what Torres is doing here, completely unaware really of everything going on in Atlantis except what has been told to him by McCaffrey, which we're going to call Volko from here on out. And Siren's going to come back and attack him one last time and really have a pretty shocking moment where she stabs Eve right through the stomach with her claws. And I thought for sure it killed her, but it looked like at the end of the episode that Eve somehow survived that and is in a coma.
Yeah, she's in the hospital awaiting treatment or some such shit.
Yeah, and so that was a pretty shocking moment. And then Volko and Arthur on the boat have to come together to try and defeat Siren and set us up moving forward in a pretty interesting place. Let's talk about Justin Hartley as AC here. This is clearly early in his career. He had not developed into what he would later develop into. He's got some shaky moments here, but overall, I think he does well for a young actor who was likely cast on his looks in this episode.
Yeah, he does well enough. I mean, he is playing the prototypical WB lead of the time. You know, like looks probably mean a bit more than acting ability. Let's be honest, and he looks the part. And as far as acting goes, it isn't terrible. Nothing in this episode blows you away, but it's not completely wooden.
Yeah, he's not. he's not completely left in the dust when he's around the good actors that are playing the supporting roles. But, you know, he's clearly had a lot of room to grow. Luckily, he would grow over the course of his time on Smallville and carve out a nice role for himself. But I have to say, I really wish he would have gotten a chance to play Arthur some more, because he does look like that prototypical mm-hmm. Aquaman, and it would have been nice to see him get a chance to grow into that role over time. I'm a little – a little confused about why this didn't look up. I'm trying to look up some information on it right now to figure out why it didn't get picked up.
Well, the manager Todd Weber intimated that it might have had to do with the UPN merger at the time.
Yes, I'm reading that right now, and it says the pilot was considered to have a good chance of being picked up with good reviews across the board, but ultimately the CW, as it was then known, passed on the show. Discussing the excitement around the project, Lou Diamond Phillips said, "There's so much buzz about it already, which is amazing. You don't usually get that with a pilot." Says there were reports of two WB pilots in contention for the new CW network, one being Aquaman, which was the front runner. However, when the CW announced its initial fall lineup, Aquaman did not make the list. It was considered a mid-season contender. Gow and Miller were so passionate about the pilot that they wanted it released in some form so the fans could see it. Let's see here. It says, Gow said in an interview later, "The implication when a network doesn't pick up a show is that the pilot sucks, and that's not the case. It's not a perfect pilot by any stretch of the imagination. We know that. There are other reasons which are a mystery to us as why the CW didn't pick it up." Apparently it just floated around. I've read some theories online that the budget was considered too high, that the network thought it would cost too much money to make it look decent moving forward. But still, when you think about some of the shows that got picked up, even by the CW, and
I was going to say, what was the first CW lineup? I don't even know.
I don't know. Let's find out. CW.
I have a feeling we're going through similar experiences right now, by the way. Greg.
What do you mean?
I heard your phone buzzing a moment ago.
Yes. Was it
friend of the show, Jeremy Reynolds?
It was friend of the show, Jeremy Reynolds.
Yep. Yes, which will explain why when he hears this podcast, he'll understand why we didn't answer and
That's exactly right.
And why you're going to call him back after we finish recording this episode.
That's exactly right. You know me so well, Nicholas.
I do know you.
2006-07 network broadcasting schedule. I can't believe that this actually exists on Wikipedia as an entry.
Wow.
But it does.
Okay.
Let's go down to the WB.
No, the CW. We want the CW.
CW.
The CW's right. Very first broadcast lineup.
Yep. All right. Here are the returning series. Seventh Heaven.
Okay, that makes sense. I don't like the show, but I understand why it would come back.
All of Us.
I don't even know what that is.
Let's click on All of Us and see what that is. An American sitcom that premiered on the now-defunct UPN network
mm-hmm.
In September 2003. It starred nobody I've heard of.
All right, moving on.
Produced by Jada Pinkett Smith and Will Smith.
Oh, okay, that makes sense then.
America's Next Top Model.
Okay.
Beauty and the Geek. I vaguely remember that.
Oh, God.
A reality show.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody Hates Chris. That makes sense. Okay. That was very successful and good. Gilmore Girls.
Okay.
Girlfriends.
I don't know what that is.
One Tree Hill.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Reba.
Of course.
Supernatural.
God. The show that will never die.
Smallville.
Yes.
Veronica Mars.
Of course.
So that's a pretty good lineup.
That's the entire lineup?
No, and there's one more. WWE SmackDown.
Oh, of course.
And then new series introduced. Here are the new series. Okay, here we go. This is where we're getting into it right now. The new series introduced. Let's see if you remember, if you recognize any of these. The Game.
The Game. Was that a predominantly black series?
Yes. Apparently it was a comedy series about football?
It is sometimes re-aired on BET and MTV, I think.
How long did it run? It ran,
I have no idea.
My God almighty, it ran for 9 seasons.
There you go.
On But it moved to BET in 2009.
There you go. Yep. There it is. Yep.
Okay. All right. Number 2, Hidden Palms.
No, I don't know what that is.
An American teen drama television series that ran from May 30 to July 4, 2007. Apparently it was a spring show for the WB. Pussycat Dolls present The Search for the Next Doll.
Oh, God. Okay.
This ran only 1 season. And finally, Runaway, a drama series that ran from September 25th to October 15th.
So there's your candidate. Runaway probably should have not happened in favor of
absolutely
Aquaman or Mercy Reef or whatever. But, you know, hindsight being hindsight.
Hindsight being whatever it is. It still just baffles me that it didn't get picked up because it's a good series. It probably would have found an audience when you consider how popular Smallville was at the time. I think there's building blocks here for a really good series, and it's kind of a shame that we never got to see it to fruition.
Yeah, I agree. It's like Millar said, I think it's not a perfect pilot, but I think it's good enough that it should have been picked up. I mean, no pilot is ever perfect. Like, think back, we've talked about so many times how if you compare that first episode of Arrow to what the show would be even 3 months later, there is no comparison in terms of the quality. Mm-hmm. Like, it got so much better so quickly that, you know, you would have to assume this would have gotten better eventually. Not that it's bad here, but I don't know. It doesn't make sense to me. Given that it's a pilot, I thought it was a pretty strong offering.
Absolutely. And even to parallel it with Smallville really found its footing later on in the series and was given a chance.
That season 1 is rough, man. I've never been able to finish it myself.
I liked it at the time, but it was aimed at me when I watched it. So, but it grows as it goes on and it builds your attachment to the character. Seasons 2 and 3 and all that stuff are really good. And this show never even got a chance to have a season 1. It's kind of ridiculous. And I think it could have been good. It's the building blocks are there for something. I think it distinguishes itself from what Smallville is too. It's not trying to tell the same story. So I thought this was a nice little hidden gem actually, compared to certainly the other prominent unaired pilot that we reviewed so far, Wonder Woman. This was leagues better.
Yeah, agree completely.
Now, what are the other ones out there that we need to take a look at? JLA we've talked about. We've got to get to that one.
Yeah, if the Marvel's Most Wanted pilot ever leaked, that would be cool.
Yes, that would be a really good one to see.
I'm trying to think of others. I don't know. I'm trying to think of what other ones there have been live action wise.
Yeah, I'm thinking about it. I don't know. Do you guys have any ideas out there of ones that we may have, forgotten about here? The Wonder Woman one is on the DC Universe one too, apparently, right? Who's Afraid of Diana Prince? Is that a different one? Isn't there a Wonder Woman one that's on the DC
Universe? Well, there was a made-for-TV movie that starred Kathy Lee Crosby. That was intended to be kind of the movie was going to lead to a series, and then the series never happened. So
we got to hit that one up for sure.
Oh, we are. That's on the schedule down the road.
Apparently, I'm reading a list here. There was a 1967 pilot called Who's Afraid of Diana Prince, a 5-minute pilot that was a proposal for a show featuring Wonder Woman. It was in the vein of Batman at that time, the 60s Batman show. But it says here the bulk of the pilot involves laughing at the homely, silly Diana Prince, whose mother berates her for not having a boyfriend. When she gazes into the mirror, she sees her alter ego, Wonder Woman, played by Planet of the Apes star Linda Harrison.
The Adventures of Superboy from 1961.
Ah, yes. Something called The Amazing Screw-On Head.
Oh, the Lock and Key pilot that didn't get picked up by Sci-Fi.
Ooh, I don't remember that even happening.
Yep.
That's right, yeah. Wonder Woman 74. Mm-hmm. Marvel's Power Most Pack. Wanted. Oh my gosh, I didn't know that existed either. Yep. Is that on the line, I wonder?
I don't know.
Let's find out. Plastic Man from 2006.
Batgirl.
What?
Yep.
1968, yeah. Wow. Interesting. Pride of the X-Men, we've already done that one. Criminy. Oh, we've never done Generation X.
Generation X, you got to do that at some point.
Yep, and Jubilation League.
Wonder Woman 2011.
I like the crop shot they have there.
It ain't bad.
But no, that's pretty well covers the gamut there. And there's all kinds of ones that did air that we got to get to as well. I think we need to do Birds of Prey at some point because I've never actually watched it.
It's on our schedule.
Well, nonetheless, we're going to bring it to an end right now, and we want to get your feedback on this TV pilot. If you watched it along with us, send us your thoughts. Did you like it? Did you not like it? What did they do right? What did they do wrong? Tweet us at gphillips8652, at nickduke87. If you have anything negative to say about us, you can tweet it to at jrsbbq. You can find us on the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. Join up with us and join the discussion there. You can also tweet us at PTBNComics, or you can send emails to the loneliest email addresses on the internet, GregP@PlaceToBeNation.com, NickD@PlaceToBeNation.com. We're going to take a break right now, and when we come back on the other side, we're going to have reading and watching. We're going to have the rundown. Well, we might have a reading and watching. We'll see.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Survey Says, Wrestling War Zone, a Monday Night Wars podcast retrospective, No Holds Barred, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. On top of that, we're also dipping into the vault, re-releasing the entire catalog of Where the Big Boys Play for your enjoyment. And in addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is loaded with great content, offering such tremendous shows covering the land of pop culture, such as Geek and Sassy, Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Sunday Groove, PTBN Play, Freak Out Drive-In, Songs with Friends, Looking Forward, Looking Back, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Conversation Comics, DC Post Crisis Management, Marvel Age, and Marvel Age Masterclass, plus weekly pod blasts that cover the gamut of comic topics. The feed is also filled with insightful sports content, including the NBA team, This Week in the NFL, and more.
And you can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com. We cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping. And download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back, Place to Be Nation listeners, to the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Emphasis on traveling.
Mm.
So,
semi-traveling.
One of the things that I want to do before we move on to our regularly scheduled segments is I want to mention a little bit of listener feedback. We haven't gotten a lot in the last week. We got some private feedback here and there telling us people enjoyed the show last week, enjoyed listening to our worst character changes in comics lists. Some even said, Nick, that we were full of piss and vinegar. But I did want to throw some attention to one listener that reached out and mentioned some of his character changes that annoyed him. And that was friend of the show, Mitch Oaken. Nick, who you often refer to as Mitch Okun.
Yes.
So he mentions on our Facebook.
That's his name. That's what I call him.
He mentions on our Facebook page, Place to Be Nation Comics, that Airwave becoming Mazer really pissed him off. I didn't know either of those names, Nick, so I Googled them.
Airwave, I know, but I have to dig back through my Green Lantern readings to remember that.
Yes, Airwave had another name. His actual name was Hal Jordan.
Yes.
Although not the Hal Jordan that is the Green Lantern, but another Hal Jordan from the Golden Age, who was the son of it's a long story, but basically at some point he became a character named Mazer, and this did not sit well with Mr. Okun, and he let it be known. He also informed us that he believes that Zorn's white star was his brain, not his entire head, to which my understanding of that, Nick, is that planet or star, when that thing explodes, we're all toast.
Mm-hmm.
He says one more day caused him to groan out loud at the mere mention of it.
Mm-hmm.
And he says he could do an entire list based on the things creator or writer Bill Mantlo did to Alpha Flight. And here's just a list that he gave for us. I don't understand this one. Sasquatch uses Snowbird's body to come back to life because his body was actually a great beast, nothing to do with gamma rays.
Mm-hmm.
So he's temporarily Wanda Langowski. Any of that mean anything to you, Nick?
No.
Now, this one I had heard about because Todd's told me about this one, and this one sounds hilarious to me. Puck isn't actually just really agile and cool little person. No, he's actually a very old, very tall man who has a demon stuck in his body, and somehow the demon's sword made him shorter every time it struck him.
Hmm.
And then he says, the worst editorial mandate of them all, which was that North Star wasn't gay, but he was literally a fairy, as in fairy folk tales, from Asgard. He had a mysterious illness where his body was breaking down from being on Midgard. These do sound like really bad changes, Nick.
Yes, all of them do. But I will take Mitch's word for it.
In any event, we are going to move on to our long-running segment where we talk about the things that we have been reading and or watching. It is a segment that we call Reading and Watching. Nick, you been reading anything?
I read some of my Geoff Johns omnibus, the Green Lantern omnibus. I reread Rebirth and Recharge, both of which we've reviewed for either the column in the olden days or on these very airwaves, and they're both really good. So there's that. And then I've also
changed over time, huh?
Nope, nothing's changed.
You're
there.
Still very good.
And then I watched a few more episodes of season 2 of Young Justice, which also continues to be good. That also hasn't changed over time, so that's all I got.
Excellent. I myself have not read anything outside of this terrible RIP that you're making.
Seven pages.
Right, and it's already felt like I've read 100.
Mm-hmm. That's because you just don't get it, Greg.
We're just not smart enough to get what he's going for with
it.
Now, what I have done, Nick, is I have completed watching Titans. I finished it off, so we can talk about Titans.
Yes.
I thought the series was good. I liked it a lot. Mm-hmm. As I've mentioned on the show before, that did not change.
Mm-hmm.
I did agree that it sputtered a little bit in the two episodes preceding the finale.
Mm-hmm.
I loved the finale, Nick. That may be where we diverge the most. I loved the finale.
I thought the finale was okay. I think leaving the first season of the show in that place is a really bad move.
I agree with that, too. I think it can be both things. I think it can be an excellent episode and not a good finale.
Yes.
And I think it falls into that category. So let's get into this a little bit, because those last three episodes, I'll be honest with you, I can't remember the third from last episode was the second Hawk and Dove episode, right?
Mm-hmm. I know.
Correct?
I can't remember if it was that or if it was the next to last episode. I don't remember. I don't remember the order of things.
There's a way that we can figure this out. And that is by buying time and pretending like we're having a natural conversation while I pull up Wikipedia to get the episode list. So, Nick, how about that weather?
Weather is certainly a thing that exists.
It is. Well, the weather outside is weather, I understand.
No, Hawk and Dawn was the second to last episode. Excuse me, the third from the last episode.
That's what I meant, yeah. Episode 9, Hank and Dawn. I thought that was pretty good overall. Jeff Johns wrote the episode. I thought it was I really got into the story of Hank and Don, his brother. I'm trying to distinguish that from Dawn, so I said it really weird. I don't know what that was about. But nonetheless, Hank and Don are interesting characters in this regard. There's a really compelling story about abuse and the brotherly relationship they have and his tie to Dawn and her story. I thought that stuff was all good. I do see where you're coming from, though, about the timing of this episode, airing this so close to the end of the season, felt like a mistake to me. I agree with you on that. Like, I think in hindsight, this should have been closer to the middle of the season rather than close to the end.
A lot of the pacing of this show, to me, feels like Walking Dead pacing when The Walking Dead is at its worst. And what I mean by that is The Walking Dead is notorious for doing an episode with a cliffhanger ending and then taking a one or two episode aside before following up on the cliffhanger ending.
Yeah.
And that is, to me, that's manipulative of your audience. Now, for a streaming service, you know, it's not as bad, I don't think. But then again, they release these episodes weekly rather than all at once. So maybe it is a bit more – it isn't as great. I don't have a problem with the episode. I think they could have easily rewritten it or restructured it to fit earlier in the season as a natural follow-on to the earlier Hawk and Dove episode. And arguably, it would have fit better and you would have had more storytelling momentum with those characters by placing these two episodes closer in proximity to one another.
What about doing it like the animated series would do, Justice League? When I say the animated series, what I meant by that. But why not do it like the animated series would do and just put it as a two-part episode?
Yeah.
About Hawk and Dove and air the back-to-back. I agree, because I thought the episode itself was good. The only minor complaint I had about the episode was, and I love Jeff Johns to death, he's my favorite writer in all of comics by a wide margin, I thought they went a little too heavy with the F-bombs in this. Mm-hmm. Primarily the scene, because it became unrealistic to me, like a bad Kevin Smith movie. There's a scene where they're getting kicked out of the college, right?
Mm-hmm.
And his younger brother, Don, the supposedly more peaceful one, delivers the line. I'm trying to remember if I can remember exactly what he says. He says, oh, yeah. He goes, kick us the fuck out. And I rolled my eyes and laughed. David can attest to that. We both laughed at that line. But it was a good episode overall. I liked the episode. The child actors were good. The adult actors were good. It was a good episode. But again, misplaced. And I totally got what you're saying about the pacing. All right. Now, the Coriander episode, which was sort of dedicated to Starfire and finally explaining that she's an alien, didn't really like this episode, to be honest with you. We did get more. The stuff with Rachel and Gar was good, as has been the case all season. Everything involving Rachel has been good. And I hate to say this at this point, Nick, but so far, almost everything involving Corey has been uninteresting to me on the episode, on the show. And this was better. This was a step in the right direction in terms of showing that she's an alien and giving us a few answers. But there was still, to me, a lack of, again, misplaced, wasn't in the right place in the season, distracting at times, and somewhat of a – it just wasn't that interesting. And I don't know what that was. Maybe that's a me thing, but like – it wasn't as interesting as I was hoping it would be when we finally found out the truth behind Starfire's origins. It also felt a little bit like they were bombarding information.
Yeah, to me, the problem is that the most interesting, like, all right, so Dick Grayson, I would agree with you, the character in the series is interesting, but the plot doesn't really revolve around him. You know what I mean? The interesting aspect of the plot throughout the entire series is Raven and the Trigon stuff, and like, where are they going with that? And every time they take one of these one or two episode diversions away from that, to me it derails the storytelling momentum a little bit. And this feels like another example of that, where we are getting some really great stuff with Raven in this episode, and every time they do an aside for a Coriander origin that isn't even really a Coriander origin. Like, they only reveal, really, she's an alien, she comes from Tamaran, but we don't really see anything about who she was before this. Like, there, you know, the only thing she knows about herself is where she comes from. She doesn't really know anything else about the person she was prior to this. So it just feels frustrating for them to continue to take asides from the main point of the plot, which continues in the season finale.
Yeah, and I didn't have as big a problem with it all as you did. It didn't take me out of the show. I still enjoyed the show, but I agree that the pacing, and it's funny and it's ironic coming from me in particular, who has criticized the Netflix Marvel shows for sometimes padding themselves out too much.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say, in this case on Titans, it felt like Titans could have used three or four more episodes to tell its story. Well, if this was the way they were going to go.
Somebody actually, I don't remember who I read, somebody that's involved with the production gave a quote that said their original season finale, they actually cut it and pushed it to be the season premiere of season two.
Oh, wow.
And I think that was a bad move.
I agree. I totally agree. Yeah, because 11 is a weird number anyway.
The argument that was made was that the show was really about Dick Grayson finding himself. True. And I would agree that's what his character arc is about. But the plot of the show Raven is the primary mover of action in the series.
Yes.
And is throughout the entire thing. And so distracting from that and taking away from that at the end makes no sense to me.
Especially,
and also,
when Dick doesn't really find himself.
Right.
Dick's left in a negative spot that we know he has to get out of eventually.
Right. And
so,
the other thing with the season finale is I agree with you. I like the events of the show, of the episode, very much. To me, though, if you're going to have an episode that heavily focuses on Batman, you got to show Batman. And I thought it became a gimmick at a certain point, them having to, like, shoot around it, and it became a little frustrating. Because you can't even really get a good fight scene in between Batman and Robin because you can't show Batman.
Right. Well, they did show Batman when he was killing all the guards.
They showed, like, glimpses and cutaway, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you're not going to be able to use the character, then don't use the character. You know what I mean? Either use him or don't.
Right. They got to have him next season.
They just have to. They should have had him in this episode.
They need to explain on the show that Bruce is not really the way that Dick's subconscious perceives him.
Right.
And in any event, that being said, I loved, as a Dick Grayson fan, I turned to David at one point during the middle of this episode, because I kind of sensed that David wasn't quite as into this finale as I was, but I turned to him and I said that, like, you got to understand, for me as a Dick Grayson fan, this episode is like crack. This is everything that I want out of a freaking Dick Grayson media property. I love the fact that he's not a kid. I love the fact that he's not a sidekick. I love the fact that in this dream scenario that we get here, he has multiple times in this episode where he chooses not to do the wrong thing. He chooses to do the right thing. And the bottom line is that Trigon manipulates him every step of the way. Every time he chooses the right thing, Trigon says that he gave him the choice. He never really gives him the choice. He continually puts impediments in his way to lead him to make the choice that he wants him to make.
Yeah.
And and yet Dick continues to find ways and try to reason and try to – he's trying to – even despite all the hatred and the – or not hatred, but all the resentment that he has towards Bruce, he still loves him. Deep down inside, he wants to save him. He wants to help him. He wants to repay him for what he did for him. And I love that. I absolutely love that. I love the way that the actor – and I apologize. I can never remember his name. But I love the way that he portrayed – Dick over the course of the season. And this episode was just great from that standpoint. I love the stuff with Jason. I loved
how much better would it have been though if it had been Barbara instead of Dove?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Would have been 100% better.
Yep.
And there's even a line in there about in this episode about Barbara having disappeared.
Yep.
And that got me intrigued as well. But again, this is a Titan show, and I'm worried that all of these morsels are being thrown out there that are not really going to get played off, because you have to at some point serve the team and not just Nightwing or Robin as your main character.
Right.
Because I got to be honest, man, as much as I love this series and I've really enjoyed this season to this point, I kind of now wish that I was just getting a Nightwing show out of it, because I understand why that can't be, and I've liked the other cast members as well. But you got to understand, Nick, I've been so ready for Dick Grayson stuff for so long, and I've never really gotten it that wasn't him being Batman's sidekick.
Honestly, I would be fine if it was nothing but Nightwing and Raven at this point. I don't think Beast Boy or Starfire are really adding anything to the proceedings.
I have enjoyed Beast Boy. I've enjoyed his relationship with Raven to this point. I thought he did a good job, too, the last few episodes of portraying the conflict in Gar about what he did to that the scientist that was torturing him. You know, he eats him at some point, and that weighs on him heavily and has scarred him in a lot of ways. So I enjoy his character. The only one that really still hasn't connected with me is Starfire, and I'm hoping that she'll connect next season, maybe when they explore some of her cosmic origins, and I'm assuming that they will get into that next year. But overall, I really enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to season two. I do agree with you that the pacing did feel off as the season got towards the end. I'm hoping that's something they can correct moving forward, assuming that the DC app is still a thing this time next year.
And that's the other frustrating part, is they end the season like this, and we have no idea really when season two is actually coming.
Yeah, they've not really announced that, have they?
It's not like a Walking Dead situation where you end on a cliffhanger and we know that like 8 months later we'll be there waiting on the follow up. We don't know when this is coming, and that makes it even more frustrating.
Yeah, we know that in just a few short weeks I'll be able to tell Nick all about the Whisperers.
Yep.
And find out what their deal is. But no, not on this. We don't know. But nonetheless, that's in the past now, and I'm looking forward to seeing what they do moving forward. Let's turn now to our weekly look at the news and notes in the world of comics. It's a segment that we call a rundown.
Welcome to the rundown. Here's where we talk some comic news. Welcome to the rundown. Here's where we talk about movies too.
Nick, welcome to the rundown.
Mm-hmm.
And kicking us off this week is the release just yesterday, in fact, of the trailer. The first was called a teaser trailer, but it's really a trailer, as far as I can tell, for the upcoming film Spider-Man Far From Home, the sequel to the highly successful, highly revered by you and respected by me and liked by me, Spider-Man Homecoming. This is a movie that we do not explicitly know when it takes place. I am going to.
It takes place after Avengers Endgame.
After Endgame, yes.
It's been confirmed.
It has?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes.
Well, there you have it. And it sees Peter Parker take a journey away from New York City and to Europe with his school mates. And while there, he encounters one Nick Fury.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're the story moving forward on this one appears to be that Nick Fury is calling Peter into action over in Europe, as we see the emergence of Jake Gyllenhaal's Mysterio, who appears at least to be a hero.
Mm-hmm.
This trailer, I gotta say, was really good, Nick, as many of these Marvel trailers are. this was a really, really good trailer and had me excited, especially for what they're going to do with Mysterio, as my opinion is he is tricking the world into thinking that he is a superhero by creating non-existent supervillains.
Yes.
Hocus Pocus.
Modeled after the Elementals from Spider-Man mythos. Hydro Man, the Molten Man, and perhaps that looked like it might have also been the Sandman.
Sandman, yeah.
In there as well. So that's all exciting stuff. For me, as an Ultimate Spider-Man fan, getting the big screen introduction of the Nick Fury-Peter Parker dynamic is what excites me the most. Because that was a notable part of the comic as it went excuse me, throughout its 150-issue run. Other stuff here, it seems like they're trying to – it's hard to base too much on the trailer, but it seems like they're softening that MJ character a little bit from Homecoming, which is a good move, I think, making her a bit more of an actual person and not just a one-note joke, honestly.
Although – pretty much everything we got in the trailer from her was more of that one note joke.
No, you got that one line, and she kind of backs off of it, you know, a little bit, opening up to show an actual person, which is the thing. Like she makes a joke at it, like kind of poking fun at herself is the way I took it. So I'm still not overly high on that interpretation of the character. Don't get me wrong, but it seems like they're trying to evolve that as we go forward. More good Ned stuff, or excuse me, Gonke stuff, because I'm going to call him that no matter what he is. Yeah, I love this trailer from beginning to end. I loved everything about it. I am amazed.
Happy Hogan and not Tony Stark, notably, in the trailer making the moves on Aunt May.
Well, yeah, because Tony's getting married, or he's married now, remember? Or getting married.
Or Tony no longer exists.
That's probably you're probably accurate in that, but he's also remember he had reconciled with Pepper in between Homecoming and this. So
Pepe.
So all that is all that's good. But yeah, love this trailer. Predictably, I am overwhelmingly excited about this franchise and this new film that's coming out in a few months.
What I loved in the trailer, all the different Spider-Man suits that we get to see.
Mm-hmm.
We saw the noir suit. We see the web wings come out on the suit.
Mm-hmm.
We see the red and black suit. Big fan of pretty much seeing all of these almost situational Spider-Man suits, would you say?
Mm-hmm.
Loved all that. Loved Mysterio having the fishbowl helmet.
Mm-hmm.
Loved it. Loved all the special effects with him. Nick Fury, awesome. In this, I love him kind of coming off like a badass again because it's been a while since we've seen Nick Fury be that intimidating figure. What else did I love in this? Happy and Aunt May, loved that part. Peter continuing to be great. Tom Holland's great as Peter. Stuff that I did not like in the trailer. The same stuff that I didn't like in Homecoming. I still don't like his high school group. I can't help it. I just... maybe it'll be different in the movie.
You've come out as a hater of kid superheroes.
I have, yes, and I also, but it's situational. There's some that I like, but I say that because that's in relation to another discussion we were having that would be difficult to explain.
The statement I believe was "fuck kid superheroes."
Yes, because we get them so much, and we've gotten them so many times over the years, and. And yes,
have
I know
we?
We've gotten adult superheroes a lot too over these. Yes, in the history of time, Smallville was about a kid superhero. Well, not kid; he's a teenager. We've gotten
but it also sucked, Greg. So
good kid
superheroes.
It's very good. Spider-Man, teen superhero. We've seen Spider-Man every time they've ever done him. He's been a high schooler when they started out.
He was a high school student for all of 15 minutes in the Raimi movies. Don't throw that at me.
I don't want to hear that. No, the entire first movie, he's in high school.
He graduates in the first movie.
I thought he graduated in the second.
No, because they show the scene of Flash and Mary Jane breaking up at graduation, literally like 15 minutes into the movie.
Oh, so what is he graduating from in Spider-Man 2? Anything?
Nothing. You're thinking of the Amazing Spider-Man 2 when he graduates.
That's what I'm thinking of is Amazing Spider-Man 2. Never mind. Yeah, I got my franchises mixed up. So regardless, we saw it for 15 minutes in Spider-Man 1. We saw it for the entire god-awful movie in Amazing Spider-Man.
Amazing Spider-Man's a wonderful film.
No, it isn't. Yeah, and then the much, much worse Amazing Spider-Man 2 has him graduate. So there's been a Superboy series in the past. There's been a constant focus on the Teen Titans. There's been constant focus on
all television properties.
Youth. This
very, very few, if any, movie properties have done that, have taken that angle. The MCU, for example, was entirely adult focused prior to the introduction of teenage Peter Parker.
And you know why, Nick? Because adult superheroes are more interesting.
I disagree.
Oh Lord!
It depends on the character, and it depends on the approach.
Yes, some kid superheroes are good, like I said, but the vast majority are much more interesting when they're older and actually doing things of note besides, how am I going to do my homework and balance with my girlfriend? No! It's good. That can work. That can work, Nick. That's a good approach to have as a thing that's different from the rest of the universe, but it doesn't work if you have multiple different things that are essentially telling the same stories. But I say that about a lot of superhero properties. Basically, what I'm getting at, it's all personal preference. I don't like those stories. I never have. I didn't like them when I was a kid. When I was a kid, I didn't want to read about kids' superheroes. I wasn't interested in their lives. I wanted to read about heroes that inspired me to want to be cool things when I grew up. You know, cool things like a newspaper reporter.
Cool things like the Big Blue Boy Scout.
That's right. That's exactly right. Inspiring me to be better than I was. Not relating to my boring, shitty, going to school every day life. Didn't want it. Didn't care for it. And I don't want it now. I like Kid Hero. We talked about how much we like Super Sons, Nick.
Wait a minute. Where are you going? Is it fuck kid superheroes, or is it I like kid superheroes? Or is it you like to fuck kid superheroes? Which one?
No, that's different. I like kid superheroes when it's appropriate. And I'm fine with you getting your precious teenage Spider-Man. If that's what everybody wants so much, to constantly have teenage Spider-Man, I'm fine with that. You can have teenage Spider-Man, but don't give me teenage X-Men.
You're not fine with it because you kind of throw shade at it whenever you get a chance.
I do, but
you're
you're
not actually fine with it. You're just saying you're fine with it to try and pretend to be a nice guy.
Sort of like you do all the time with every project that you don't like. Word. That's fine if you like that. I just won't watch it.
Yeah, it just sucks.
That's the thing though. You can have your teenage Spider-Man, but don't give me teenage X-Men.
Greg,
I don't need it.
The X-Men literally run a school. What do you want?
They're not the kids.
They were. That's how the whole thing started.
That's how it started. And the much more interesting, much more well-known versions of the X-Men, they're grown-ups. They're done with being kids. Claremont stuff, they're not kids anymore. Kitty Pryde was a kid, and you can have kid characters in the X-Men. But the vast majority of the X-Men, I don't want to see be kids. I want to see them be adults doing interesting adult things. And then have Kitty Pryde be the point of view kid character who's amazed and in a wondrous world of all these cool mutants doing these crazy things while she's trying to learn how to control her powers. That's a fine story to tell. But I don't need stupid Ned and his stupid unfunny jokes all the time. Or look at her. She's the cliche. What's that? Judd Nelson character from Breakfast Club. Playing Mary Jane. I don't need that. You can have that. That's fine. People like it. I just want to see cool, good superheroes. And I think we're going to get that. I like the Spider-Man stuff in the movie and in this next movie. I just don't happen to like the high school stuff. Personal preference, Nicholas. Personal preference. Mm-hmm. And what's wrong with that?
I didn't say there's anything wrong with it.
Didn't say there's anything wrong with it. You are trying to cast aspersions on my feelings towards youth-oriented superheroes.
You cast aspersions towards your own feelings, sir. I am just relaying what you have said to our fine listeners out there.
I liked Super Sons. I liked plenty of child superhero books over the years. But again,
you'll take every opportunity to remind people that I hate kid actors. But when I bring up kid superheroes, you're like, no.
I've already admitted that I like kid superheroes only in certain situations. Mm-hmm. But I don't want a universe of them.
No one is suggesting a universe of them, Greg.
Oh, I'm sure you're going to be arguing for Kid Thor soon, too. How about that, huh?
No. Although Kid Loki was pretty good when that happened.
Kid Loki was good, yes. Yeah. I agree. Kid Loki was fun. Kid Lobo.
Lobo's daughter. What's her name?
Yeah, I think her name is Lobo's daughter, isn't it?
I don't know. They gave her some, Crush, I think, is her name. Kona Crush.
Axe Smash.
Yeah, you know. Hole in one Barry Darso.
Oh. Hey. Speaking of Hole in One Barry Darso.
Yeah.
There may be a new podcast launching soon revolving around the many characters.
You actually agreed to do it.
I did agree to do it. But
I look forward to private messages about now I got to do freaking the insert podcast here tonight instead of sitting on my ass at home.
Oh no, I'm in good company with this one at least. So I'm looking forward to talking wrestling with my friends. And if I can't make it on an episode, they are more than capable of carrying anything. I shall say no more until we make our announcement public.
Mm-hmm.
You see, we haven't actually settled on a name yet, Nick.
Right, I understand.
So, if you have any ideas, know where to contact.
I have no ideas. Survey Says, I think, is a good one.
I like that idea. I think we should do that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we got a good crew, I think, lined up for our show, and it should be fun.
Let's see. Let's count them. Hold on. So how about Sloppy Seventh? I think that's a good one.
Will you stop?
No.
I knew the answer to that before I even asked.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, you're not invited, Nick.
I'm. My heart weeps, sir. Much like it weeps for Inky's payroll woes.
Hey, the system's broken.
Yep. It's broken because the high market teams won't spend more money.
In any event, Nick, you keep that up, you won't be asked to do any more tailgates.
Oh, God. My heart weeps yet again.
Oh,
my heart does a lot of weeping today, apparently.
You're surly this week, man.
I didn't do anything.
You're just surly. In any event, we'll invite you on when we talk about Horace Hogan.
No, I again, I'm good. Thank you, though.
Come on. You love Horace. Who doesn't?
I don't know. Irrational people.
Paramount is developing a new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles film franchise.
Already.
Separate from its previous Michael Bay-produced films.
Mm-hmm.
This will be produced by A Quiet Place producers, Andrew Form and Brad Fuller.
That's a weird fit.
Who worked with Bay on the previous iteration of the franchise.
Oh, never mind. What the hell?
Do we care anymore?
No, like that's the thing. Like, this is technically, you know, the Turtles got their start in comic books, so it's technically comic book related. Yeah. But like,
I think there's a lot of people that do care about the Turtles.
I think you and but here's my argument. I am not saying that there aren't people who came to the Turtles through the comics. I know that there are, and there's a lot of those people, and that's great. But I think we would all acknowledge that the Turtles are primarily popular because of the, you know, late 80s and early 90s animated series that had nothing really to do with the comic book other than, like, the general concept. Like, from a tonal standpoint, from a storytelling standpoint, even mm-hmm. from a characterization standpoint, nothing. It's completely divorced. And as much as I loved the show at the time, I was a massive Turtles fan, if you try to go back and watch it, let's all be honest, Greg, it's not very good. It doesn't hold up very well. And so for a large generation of kids, or a generation of adults now who grew up with the show, you're constantly trying to chase this nostalgic feeling of
something that doesn't exist.
That doesn't exist. Does not hold up in hindsight. You're trying to...
Something that was aimed at kids.
Right.
You know, and was good for kids.
Right.
But you can never recapture that as an adult.
Right. And if you try to make something that's aimed at kids now, adults are going to hate it. And if you try to make something that's aimed at adults,
kids are going to hate it.
You're defeating the entire purpose.
Yep.
It's the same thing with the Power Rangers, honestly. Like,
yep.
If you're not going to make a cheesy, stupid, over-the-top Turtles movie, I don't really have any interest in it. And even if you make that, I don't really have any interest in it. So,
yes. Now, I will say the original movie, I think, still holds up pretty well. And it's kind of a dark and kind of...
I would agree. I would agree that that holds up, but I think that movie was well received at the time in spite of how dark it was. Like, yeah. It was well received because the Turtles were a pop culture phenomenon, and it was able to succeed on the strength of the name alone. And now 20 years later or 30 years later, it holds up because it wasn't the show. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But I think what people have constantly tried to do over the last 10 to 15 years is recapture that feeling of the show, which wasn't that good. So it's one of those things.
In many ways, that's kind of what we've been doing in pop culture for years now, is trying to recapture. We're as guilty of it as anyone with our own individual pet favorite projects, right, or properties. We become slaves to nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
And we continually chase this idea that is not – that nothing is going to be able to satisfy what we want it to be.
Right.
That part of us is no longer there.
Right, because we were talking about in the live chat – or in our, not the live chats, in our comics chat, like something like the Terminator franchise. Like, mm-hmm, I'm not just looking for a good Terminator movie. I'm looking for a movie that is going to make me feel the way I felt when I was 5 years old watching Terminator 2. You know what I mean? Right. And that's just not a thing that happens anymore. So
No. And it's the same with a lot of these franchises that we see ourselves going to the well with. Transformers, for instance.
And Greg, that is the ultimate, like, compliment towards something like The Force Awakens, because you can sit here and call it derivative or, like, repetitive, but I think we would all agree there were moments when you were watching The Force Awakens where, yeah, you felt that again.
Mm-hmm.
And as staunch a defender of The Last Jedi as I have been, there those moments are few and far between, or arguably non-existent in The Last Jedi. Whereas in The Force Awakens, there were those moments where you felt whatever that feeling is.
Right, you're stuck between creating this nostalgic loop.
Mm-hmm.
Or doing something so wildly different with the franchise that it is no longer recognizable as that franchise.
And thus arguably because you have to evolve as a result. Right.
Right. Like Ninja Turtles, arguably, if you want to do something new with it, needs to evolve completely beyond everything that we have as a conception of it.
Right.
But we would not accept that because we, again, are looking for something to recreate what we felt when we were kids.
And specifically, like one artistic interpretation of it. Like,
yes.
Yeah, you brought up a good point. The 90s movies, I think, are still pretty well regarded. But, like, most of us, when we think of the Turtles, that's the first place we go is that animated series. And it's like – it's a version that you can't really do anymore, you know?
No. Yeah. I mean, I want Krang in the stomach of a giant bald muscle suit.
Right.
Talking about – Shredder!
With a tuning fork on his head. Don't forget the tuning,
yeah,
fork.
Yeah.
And a furrowed brow. The suit had a permanently furrowed brow.
Yep, I want Uncle Phil's voice as the Shredder.
Oh, God, yes.
I mean, it's – and there's just things that you can't get anymore. And it really – you know, we're saying this, and we do a podcast dedicated to a medium that is built on nostalgia, that literally exists.
But a media that is entirely dependent on the idea that characters can reinvent themselves over and over again.
True.
Over the course of decades, or else – they wouldn't exist anymore. Like,
right.
Even someone like Superman, who you could argue is probably the character that has changed, you know, relatively the least over time, has still had to periodically update himself to remain relevant, you know, as we go forward.
Right, right. And we see, even with superhero comics, that there's almost this inescapable nostalgia element that no matter what you change, eventually everything returns to the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's at this point, maybe we need to move on from the Turtles and try something new and create something new for a new generation and let them have their thing. And then, you know, we can focus on our own original ideas, like, you know, another Lethal Weapon or another Die Hard.
Yeah. Or another, like I said, Terminator movie.
Yeah. Right. Die Hard. Oh, Lord. Talk about a franchise that ran itself off the rails.
Yeah. Do we really want another Die Hard at this point?
No.
Unless it's the reboot with Taylor Lautner playing John McClane.
No, I think we need a true sequel. It needs to be called Die Easy, and it's about John McClane being old. And
John McClane is in a medical coma, and it's about his bitch of a wife coming back to pull the plug. Well, that was easy. It's over in 30 seconds.
it turns out dying wasn't that hard after all.
Oh, that's actually a brilliant idea for the last movie in that franchise. Is like, you call it Die Easy, and then if there's a Die Hard movie that plays out, and then at the end you reveal it was all in his head as he was dreaming prior to his wife pulling the plug.
And his rosebud moment is just him dropping a little flask onto the ground.
Yep, there you go. And then, like, the last moment of his hallucination is him in the limo with what was the guy's name?
Reginald Val Johnson.
No, the limo driver. What was the limo driver? Oh, right, Die Hard. Arnaud or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Anyway, The Flash is back. We haven't watched it yet, but it is back. Mm-hmm. And exciting news coming because Jesse L. Martin is returning as Detective Joe West. He has recovered from his back injury, and he will be back in the new stretch of season or of episodes, the second half of the season.
Awesome news.
And they said they will even provide an explanation of what's been going on with him. And something else going on down the line. So I'm pretty excited about this. Flash is really picking up the pace towards the end of the first half of the season. Mm-hmm. So looking forward to seeing where it's going.
Absolutely.
And with that being said, that wraps up that segment of the show, which went on in various directions of note. But here we are with our grandfather clock in the studio, and the minute hand has just crossed over. So I'm going to put a minute on the clock here, Nick. Mm-hmm. It's time for the wrestling minute.
Mm-hmm.
Good week of wrestling television here from WWE, I thought.
Yeah, I didn't catch all of SmackDown. I saw the opening portion of it. I have not seen the Rey Mysterio and Andrade. Now we're just calling him Andrade, by the way. Match that you've raved so much about. But I did catch Raw, and that was a pretty decent episode of the flagship program, and interesting development with, presumably, I would assume, the demon Finn Balor getting ready to take on the beast Brock Lesnar at the Royal Rumble pay-per-view.
Yeah, in front of a bigger Royal Rumble crowd than we're used to. Mm-hmm. That's going to be a good match. I'm excited about that development. I thought the match was really good for the setup, and especially if he busts out the demon, that's going to be a compelling match to watch. And apparently, if you believe the rumors, Brock actually requested this match.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, I mean, he's right. If you believe that report, you look back at his best matches in the company, and most of them have been against the smaller, more athletic-type guys, the Daniel Bryans and AJ Styles of the world. So this makes sense.
Absolutely. And then we also got a new Intercontinental Champion in the almighty Bobby Lashley.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What a nickname that is. Yes. And again, a good match, I thought. I'm unsure where this leaves Dean Ambrose.
Yeah, me too. I don't know what to make of that, but what can you do?
What can you do? I'm also you need to catch up on SmackDown. That match between Rey and Andrade was very good, and I am cautiously optimistic that the Shane and Miz storyline might lead somewhere. I didn't hate the segment as much as I thought I would, but yeah, good episode overall.
Yep, there you go.
And that's been the wrestling a little bit more in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But with that being said, we will come back to you next week, folks, hopefully, if I can get it read, with the Long Book Hunter's review of Batman RIP.
Already hedging his bets. I love it.
Including Monsieur Le Bossy. Who else is in that? El Flamingo, I believe, is in that. El Sombrero, which of course means the hat.
The hat, yep.
And all the great original new villains that were introduced during that run that have stuck around for so many years, Nick, because they're so iconic.
Yeah, absolutely. So looking forward to bringing that to you next week. And of course, we end the show, as we have done now for some time, with a little musical exit from Jim Ross, from WWE Hall of Famer.
Before we introduce Mr. Ross, I have to break the fourth wall here just a little bit, ladies and gentlemen. My favorite thing about these lyrics that I'm looking at right now on this here sheet is whoever wrote them misspelled Dwight Yoakam's name.
Well, now don't tell tales out of school.
All right.
Because
let's do it.
Before we bring WWE Hall of Famer Jim Ross in, you know, Mr. Ross, and you can comment on this when you feel the need to, but rumors continue to abound that you might be making an appearance at a certain event in Las Vegas, Nevada. At the
let me cut you off right there. I know where you're going. You're going to be like all these Richards on the internet that are spreading rumors. Oh, JR signed with AEW. Oh, JR signed with AEW. JR's monitoring AEW. Look, I am monitoring. I'm monitoring the situation. I ain't signed with no AEW. Mm-hmm. The only thing that I've been doing is sitting here with an A&W root beer in my hand and watching these events unfold. I have not signed any documentation. I have not signed with them. My contract with WWE
goes till
Tino, and maybe you'll think to yourself that, you know, you're feeling a little lucky. And so in the spirit of that, why don't you take it away?
Well, I appreciate that introduction, even though you are spreading rumors and innuendo and the dirt sheet writers are going to pick up on, I'm sure. Now, here's how it goes, folks. Well, I woke up this morning, stumbled out of my rack. I opened up the paper to the page in the back, which I believe was the sports section, indicating that the Oklahoma Sooners have just landed quarterback Jalen Hurts. Now, I'd suggest that Lincoln Riley's going to know quite a bit of what to do with that young man. But anyway, that's beside the point. It only took me a minute for my finger to find my daily dose of destiny under my sign. My eyes just about popped out of my head. Now, that ain't the first time that's happened to me, by the way. It said, the stars are stacked against you, girl. Get back in bed. I said, girl. I ain't no girl. I am a man. I was raised to be a man in this industry. And I will continue to be that no matter what the hell you have to say. Anyway, I feel lucky. Well, I feel lucky, yeah. No Professor Doom is going to stand in my way. Oh, I feel lucky today. Well, I strolled down to the corner. Gave my numbers to the clerk. The pot is $11 million, so I called in sick to work. Now, I've never done that before. I believe in working sick. I don't believe in missing dates, ladies and gentlemen. When you sign on the dotted line and you shake a man like Vince McMahon's hand, you are agreeing to show up whether you are sick, whether you are tired, whether you are injured, and whether you are dead. If you are a corpse, you will show up to work if you shake that man's hand. Anyway, I bought a pack of Camels. You know, I recently quit the habit of smoking, but at this time I was still doing it. Camels, a burrito, and a Barks. Now, I usually drink A&W, but in this case, I drank a Barks root beer. I crossed against the light, made a beeline for the park. Well, the sky began to thunder. Sounded like the Undertaker was coming to the ring. The wind began to moan. I heard a voice above me saying,
Yeah, girl, you better get back home.
Well, I feel lucky. I feel lucky. Oh, yeah. No tropical depression is going to steal my son away. I feel lucky today. Anyway, 11 million later, I was sitting at the bar. I bought the house a double, then the waitress a new car. Dwight Yoakam's in the corner, trying to catch my eye. Lyle Lovett is right beside me, with his hand up on my thigh. The moral of the story, folks, it's simple, but it's true. Hey, the stars might lie, but the numbers never do. I feel lucky. I feel lucky, oh yeah! Hey, Dwight. Hey, Lyle. Boys, you don't have to fight. Hot dog, I feel lucky tonight. I feel lucky. Think I will flip a coin. I'm a winner either way. Now, wait just a minute here. I am not going to fornicate with Dwight Yoakam, much less Lyle Lovett, for God's sake, or in any kind of combination thereof. I mean, I resent that implication of these lyrics. I don't like it. I'm not in favor of it. Now, if it were Danny Hodge, Dr. Death, Stone Cold, Jack Swagger, someone like that, I could see that. Baker Mayfield, certainly. But Dwight Yoakam, and Lyle Lovett. My God, give me some credit, for God's sake.